Moncrief on News Talk.
The West Cork Literary Festival starts this evening, and one of the highlights on Monday will be Neil Jordan. He'll be in conversation in the Maritime Hotel in Bantry, talking about his career and his memoir, Amnesiac. Neil, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Why is it called Amnesiac?
Because it's a memoir, you know. And, you know, when you try and remember things, you wonder, did you actually remember them as they actually happened? Or are you remembering the way your parents told you things that happened? Or are you even able to separate reality from fantasy in any way whatsoever? I mean, I've lived my entire life creating fantasies, you know, so it was interesting to try and see, was there any reality behind my memories?
Did you have to go and check things at people?
Sometimes, yeah, I did. You know, some of them are not around anymore, you know.
But, yeah.
I did. Yeah. Basically.
And writing a memoir, and given that you've written so many novels and movies, was it a different process in terms of, well, what's going to be interesting or what's going to be compelling, or how did you judge what to include or not, or to what not to include?
Well, I didn't even know I wanted to write when I was asked by the publisher to write a memoir. And I began, you know, I began describing when my mother was in Beaumont Hospital, and I picked her up and driven her out to Bettystown, where we spent time as kids. And we stopped at a little what used to be a post office and had a cup of coffee. And she told me she was born there. And that really shocked me. I had no memory of that fact of her ever having told me that before, you know. So I began writing that, and then it became, you know, it became a kind of an exploration of my own memories and the reality behind them. And, you know, and I mean, I didn't want to write anything about, you know, meeting famous people or the making movies that people may or may not have seen, you know. I really just wanted to see, was there any, you know, anything interesting behind my own experience. Most of it is about growing up in Dublin in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, I was born in Sligo, you know, but I was brought up in Dollymount, you know, and so I'm kind of a countrified dub in a way, or, you know, and it was lovely to, you know, to trawl my way through memories of the world the way it was then in Ireland and in Dublin, you know.
Yeah.
It was also kind of harrowing in a way, you know, but for me, it was like an exploration of, you know, whatever led to whatever I am, you know.
Your mother was a painter.
She was.
Yeah. And
a very good one, actually.
Was that a vivid memory of you? I mean, of her work rather than memories of her working.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons I called her Amnesiac, because, you know, a lot of my memories are connected with her paintings. Like, I was born in Ross's Point, and I seem to have a memory of Coney Island, and not Coney Island in New Jersey or wherever the hell it is, but in New York, but Coney Island in Sligo, and of a metal man, you know, that was kind of a feature of the seascape there. And I seem to have this very vivid memory of that. And then I looked at the paintings that she has done from that period, because I could look at them. And I see exactly that painting that seems to cohere with my memory. And I'm wondering, am I remembering the painting or remembering the actual scene that I witnessed as a kid in a pram, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
So it was intriguing in that way to write it or to explore those things, you know.
If it's not too literal, did your mother's style of painting have any sort of an influence on you as a director?
Well, she put paints and, you know, painting materials in her hands at a very young age. You know, my sister Ethna, as you know, her whole career is as a painter, you know, and I used to paint when I was younger. I kind of grew out of it, but maybe she implanted a visual imagination, you know, that you can't quite get rid of, you know. So maybe when I began to construct images through the camera, you know, maybe that's what led me to be able to do that, because I take a great pleasure out of constructing a scene, you know, when I'm making a movie, you know.
Yeah. And when you were at school, you were briefly taught by John McGahern. Would your father have been McGahern's boss?
No, my father was school inspector.
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah.
He was a Kigra.
Yeah.
Yeah. And You know, so I didn't fully understand the response. I went to Belgrove Primary School, you know, so he would come around and he'd have to look at what they were doing. And John McGahern actually said I was a, you know, the living contradiction of all his educational theories. But, you know, they were afraid of him and I was afraid of them. Everyone was afraid of everybody in those days, you know.
Yeah. But McGahern kind of disappeared because of his relationship status.
No, that's a famous, it's a famous incident where John had published a book, I think it was called The Dark, his first book.
Mm.
And he was teaching us in Belgrove. And, you know, every, like at the time, every guard and every teacher was from the country. Okay. I never understood why, but they were. Yeah. And they were often tall and wore tweed kind of suits and all that sort of stuff. And one day John just vanished. We had no idea where he'd gone, you know, and he was replaced by some other teacher. There was no explanation to the 30 or so kids that he was in charge of at the time. And just later, subsequently, we found out that he had to leave. He had been asked to leave because, not because he had published a banned book, which he had, but because he had married, I think, a Scandinavian divorcee, you know, which was regarded as sufficiently shocking to prevent him from having access to us young, you know, roustabouts who were eight and nine at the time, you know.
Was it, and was that unacceptable? Who was it unacceptable to other parents or to the priesthood? Or?
Oh, no, it was, this is a famous event. I mean, John McGahern himself has written about it. He wrote a book called The Leave Taking, yeah?
Mm.
You know, where my father actually is a character in the book, you know. And, I mean, I think the reason I wrote about it in the memoir is because it seemed the portrait you get of Ireland at the time is that it was utterly dominated by the church and the Catholic Church and all that sort of stuff, you know, and by conservative teaching unions. And actually, what happened when I spoke to my father about it, he told me that the parish priest didn't want to get rid of John at all because he was in charge of the church or in charge of the school, Belgrove School, as parish priests were then. The National Teachers Organization didn't want to couldn't get rid of him because they wouldn't allow it, basically, you know. And I think you would have needed an act of parliament to remove a teacher from a job at the time, you know, or an act of God. But the parents in Clontarf came en masse to the parish priest, and who was the in charge of Belgrove School, Belgrove Primary School, and demanded that he be removed because they didn't want such a sexually promiscuous figure, or whatever the term would be at the time, such a suspicious figure, teaching their children, you know. So, and that to me told me that, you know, the entire society was conspired in this weird kind of mindset of the time. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. With the benefit of hindsight, so many, and you know, so many horrific things came to light subsequently. And it, from this end of history, it seems easy to just blame the church rather than everybody was involved in some way or another.
That told me that the entire society was involved, you know. I mean, how old are you?
It's
a terrible question to
it's 63. I'm 63.
Okay. I remember going in the 30 bus, okay, from... We'd go on the 30 bus from Marlborough Street, it was, to Dollymount Avenue, okay?
Yeah.
And on the way, you would pass three churches that you could see, yeah? And others that you couldn't see, yeah? The entire church would bless themselves after they passed every church.
Yeah.
The entire bus would bless themselves as they passed every church. Half of them would bless themselves even when they passed churches you couldn't even see. Do you understand what I mean? Mm. I mean, that was the nature of the world then. To me, it was weird and it was kind of odd. But I do think it's odd in retrospect to blame every religious kind of organization for what the entire society conspired in and actually seemed to want, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, thank God they don't want it anymore.
Yes. You know, we can have a different set of criticisms of Ireland now. When you began writing, was it your father wasn't particularly keen on you taking up that as a career?
No, he was kind of terrified, I think, you know, because he was a teacher. He became a professor. He He taught education in St. Pat's and Drumcondra, which again was dominated by the church, you know.
Mm.
And half his co-practitioners would have been priests, you know. So maybe he was just a bit afraid of the untrammeled imagination, maybe, you know. I say that in retrospect, but at the time it seemed it was a little bit more scary than that, you know.
Yeah.
I had nothing to do but write, really, you know. Mm.
Though in your written work, you kind of mine family stories and the like. How was that reacted to by your family?
I'm not even sure they read them, you know. I don't think so, you know. I mean, I don't think I ever had a conversation with my father about writing, our mother. No, I had a conversation about, you know, this is perhaps, there would be severe judgment passed, whatever I was scribbling. But I don't think I ever had a conversation about a published book, you know. When I began to make movies, you know, they watched them with great pleasure. And maybe they felt films were not as personal as the books I was writing. But in fact, they were just as personal, really, in the end, you know.
Mm. But is that something you kind of realized later, or you were conscious of at the time when you were making them?
Well, no, when you're making a movie, you're surrounded, you're like somebody who's dumped into a frying pan, basically, you know. It's hard to work out what you're doing, you know what I mean? But when they did present a season of my films in the Irish Film Institute, you know. And I always thought when I was making a movie, I was disguising my real intentions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was forced to look back on the films I'd made, I was shocked at how revealing they were of the person I was at the time, you know. From Angel through to Company of Wolves, to Mona Lisa, to The Crying Game, you know, to a little movie I made called The Miracle, which very few people saw, you know, even to the films I'm planning to make at the moment, you know. But yeah. it's a very beautiful medium, film making, you know. When it's, you know, when you're allowed to do it properly, it's a beautiful thing, you know.
Yes. Has it become increasingly difficult to do it properly?
Yeah. Well, come on, I just heard you're about to review Superman. How many Supermans have you seen?
I don't know, but I don't even know.
The first by Richard Donner was marvelous, you know, and then there was one that Dick Lester directed, which was kind of hilarious, wasn't it? But I mean, that's what cinema has become. You know, they just remake these stories that are so familiar to people that they go along and they know exactly what they're going to see, and they're disappointed if they don't see exactly what they thought they were going to see. You know, it's become a different thing.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to experience it when there was some freedom, you know, and when independent movies were actually, you know, were kind of welcomed by audiences, you know, in America and in England and Ireland and Europe as a whole, you know.
Yeah. Another thing you mentioned in the book is that you have psoriasis.
I had.
Yeah, you had. Did you get rid of it?
You don't get rid of it. It comes and goes.
Yeah. But like,
no,
when you do
novel,
have it, is
the,
it severe?
The last novel I wrote was called The Well of St. Nobody, and I kind of invented this pianist whose career was stopped by the fact that his hands didn't work anymore because he had arthritic psoriasis.
Oh.
It was something that hit me a few years ago, but it went, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering that because, as you probably know, John Updike always had severe psoriasis and wrote about it quite a lot.
Did he? I didn't know that.
Oh, you did, yeah. It seemed to have had a profound, or at least in his telling, had a profound effect on his life.
Psychosomatic diseases. Maybe he was too kind of, maybe he's too emotional.
Yes.
Maybe I'm emotional as well. Yeah.
Now, a lot of people are texting in just naming films. The Crying Game, did the word transgender, you know, spoiler alert, folks, did the word transgender even exist at that time when The Crying Game came out?
No, I don't think it did, you know. I mean, people will correct me, you know, and people will throw things at me if I get this wrong, but I don't think it did, because at the time I used to know a nurse, okay? Do you remember the Bailey Hotel?
Yeah.
The Bailey Bar, yeah?
Yeah.
I remember I met this nurse, this years ago, even before I wrote The Crying Game, and she used to be an assistant in a hospital in England that performed trans operations, yeah? And she described the operation to me exactly, you know, how they remove the kind of erectile tissue around the penis and they create a comparable kind of space for the trans person and stuff like that. And to me, I was going, whoa, extraordinary, you know? Mm. And I don't, why am I saying this? I shouldn't be saying this. But it's when I came to make the movie, or to write the movie, that was about just afterwards, you know what I mean? And I think trans kind of awareness was in its infancy, you know? And I cast Jay Davidson, who was not transgender, nor was he a transvestite. He was a very, very well-balanced gay man, you know? And but he was the only person that I could see that would be able to, you know, create the necessary illusion, you know, for the central character played by Stephen Ray, that he had met a woman, you know, when in fact what he met was, you know, a transgender person, really, what we call now, you know, or a pre-op transgender person. Yeah. But we had to populate the world around Jay, the bar that he went into and all that sort of stuff. So I met the entire trans community in London, it seemed, at the time, you know, and we cast many of them in the film, you know, in the broader environments of the film that the character Stephen Ray encountered, you know. So it was, but I think the current awareness of trans issues, you know, was a later development. I say that, but people would correct me. I mean, maybe you can correct. You can check.
And now, as you know, it's very much a kind of a hot button issue between
very much
left and right and all that stuff.
I don't know why it's a left-right issue, you know.
Yeah, I don't
surely
know why either.
Surely it's an issue of physical, human, mental health, you know, and sexual health and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's the domain of the left or the right, you know.
But the famous scene, excuse me, probably the most famous Mickey Flash in cinematic history, and then Stephen Ray's immediate reaction to that. Has that been judged again, you know, decades later when, you know, when attitudes are different, as the film was making some comment on that?
Well, no, I mean, the film wasn't making comments. The point is that the character Fergus met what he thought was the lover of the soldier for whose death he was responsible, you know? So he met what he thought was a woman. And then when he finds out that actually he's a transgender man, you know, of course he'd be shocked. You know, of course he'd be surprised. I mean, that was the point of the story. He had to be surprised because he then had to process the information and realize that what he loved was the person, you know, not the gender. So, I mean, I don't understand that argument at all. It's really, it's kind of strange, really. But, I mean, he had to be. I think the problem is that Jim Carrey made a movie, didn't he? And he, you know, a lot of people began to refer to that particular scene in a certain way. And also, the problem was that actually Miramax and Harvey Weinstein publicized the movie as the film with a secret, you know? It was much more than a film with a secret. It was much more than that. You know, it was a film about somebody discovering dimensions to their own humanity that they didn't know existed before, you know? And it was a thriller, and it was a complicated thriller. It was a lot more than a film with, oh my God, shock, horror, a secret. Do you understand what I mean? But, but you know, Harvey was a genius at marketing, and that's what he did. Anyway.
Over the course of your career, have you found, like, because, you know, every director has successful film, the odd one that doesn't do so well. You know, when you've come out of a film that didn't do well, was it harder to get the next gig? Is there a little bit of an uphill climb again?
Of course there is, yeah. It's much harder, yeah. But then you're always surprised. Like, do you know what Tubi is? Do you know what Tubi is?
No.
Tubi. It's a streaming service in the United States. It's a free streaming service that's been set up. A movie I made that was an absolute disaster called High Spirits, last week was number one on Tubi.
Huh.
Okay, now work that out. I can't work that out. You know, I don't know why or how, but it was, you know, ahead of Independence Day and ahead of some Steven Spielberg films, stuff like that, you know. So I suppose I'm lucky enough to have made some movies, you know, that survived the trauma of the making of them, you know, and that people responded to and actually liked, you know, and remember, really, you know.
Was it always a trauma making films?
Well, no, it's a bit like a battleground, you know. First of all, you've got to get the money, you know. Then you've got to convince the financial people that what you're thinking, like, for example, The Crying Game, that you can make a movie about race, about terrorism, about gender, about sexuality, that will be interesting enough for people to go to see, you know. And then having done that, you have to make sure that you preserve the central idea through the, you know, through the chaos of the making of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very, you have to be very decided, really, yeah. You know.
And the film you're working on now, The Well of St. Nobody, which is based on your book, of course, what stage are you at with that?
I don't know. I'm looking. If you know anyone with $10 million to give me, I'll make it, okay?
Okay, all right. We'll just put it out there.
Put it out there, yeah.
If anyone has... Okay. Finally, what was the deal with Riviera?
What do you mean?
The TV show. I mean, there was a general perception that you were involved in it and then you perhaps distanced yourself from it.
Well, I mean, I was involved in this. I kind of made, you know, I kind of came up with the story. I came up with the broader story. I wrote the two or three scripts. I wanted to make a Patricia Highsmith kind of, you know, a really tangled, complicated thriller about wealth, about, you know, things everybody is interested in nowadays, about, you know, what was that series about the wealthy family in New England, you know, the Scottish actor, what was it called? Succession. Yeah. I mean, I really wanted to make a tangled, you know, kind of dark thriller about rich people doing evil things, you know, and it began to turn into something different. And, you know, so I decided not to direct the first two episodes as I had intended to do, and, you know, that I decided just to let them go ahead and make what they wanted themselves, really.
Okay.
Yeah. And it became quite successful, but I did feel it could have been much better. That's all I can say.
Oh, yeah. I think you're not wrong there.
Okay.
I think many...
Okay. Did many people feel that, didn't they?
Well, many people would agree with that.
Okay. Okay. We'll leave it at that. I don't think I'm allowed to talk about it, actually.
No, of course not. No. And somebody's texting in to say, Neil, High Spirits was a brilliant film.
Ha ha. Thank
you. So there you go. There you go.
Okay. Okay. You can get it on Tubi. Okay.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, now this is a totally irrelevant, almost a totally irrelevant fact I'm going to tell you, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because this is probably the only time I'm ever going to talk to you. We're No Angels, the film that you made, and there was a 1955 movie, We're No Angels, of the original movie, there was a play that was kind of a spin-off, did quite well on Broadway. When I was in school, I was in that play. It was called My Three Angels, yes.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So
cool.
I was kind of in a Neil Jordan movie
We're No Angels, now that you mention it, oddly enough, has just been remastered and re-released on Blu-ray. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yep. On a DVD. It's available on DVD. So, you know, sometimes people revisit these things and they see different qualities in them. We're No Angels was not a hit at the time, but, you know, I did enjoy making it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, people can go out and get it and then wonder which one I am, which obviously I'm not. Neil Jordan will be in conversation on Monday, July the 14th at 8:30 in the Maritime Hotel in Bantry. You can go to westcorkmusic.ie/literary festival to find out all the information there. Neil, lovely to talk to you. Thanks very much for doing so.
Thank you much, Sean. Goodbye now.
Take it handy.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.